Okay, well, welcome to Colloquium. It's another week and we're virtual today. As people continue to file in, we'll just go ahead and get started with the announcements. And I don't actually have any for this week. Does anyone need to share anything? If you do, just raise your hand or unmute and say it. Okay, we'll take a look at the slides, and we will let Rex introduce our speaker.
Hi, everyone. My name is Rex Aleria. I'm a second year PhD in the Forestry and Resource Department and part of the GES Center. Our speaker today is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Southern California. Her research focuses on exploring the historical, cultural, and sociopolitical factors that influence human-animal relationships in science and technology, with particular attention to mosquito-transmitting pathogens and transgenic mosquitoes. Her interdisciplinary scholarship has garnered significant recognition, including the Esteem Award of Best Dissertation in the Social Sciences from the Brazilian section of the Latin American Studies Association. Her manuscript title, "The World Will Become Brazil: Ecologies, Epidemics, and the Reinvention of Mosquito Science," argues that mosquitoes and their involvement in various scientific and health endeavors can be viewed as a manifestation of Brazil's racialized political agenda. Also, one notable contribution of our speaker today is her article titled "Becoming Without: Making Transgenic Mosquitoes and Disease Control in Brazil," which we will be hearing a lot about today. This publication and her prestigious award in 2020 by the Rappaport Student Paper Award from the Anthropology and Environment Society of the American Anthropological Association. Please, let's welcome Dr. Luisa Hayes Castro.
Thank you so much for this kind presentation, and I'm going to share slides here. So first, I just wanted to say it's an honor to present some of my work here today, and I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation. As Rex mentioned, I'm an assistant professor in anthropology, but I have an interdisciplinary training in anthropology and in something called science and technology studies. So I'll talk a little bit about where I'm speaking from disciplinary. And I'm sure most of you know what STS is. I saw there are some STS faculty affiliated with GIS, with the GIS Center. But for those of you who may not know, in very simple terms, STS is an interdisciplinary field that examines science and technology in their historical, social, political, economic, and cultural contexts. One of the tenets that, as a field, we argue is against this idea that science and technology is something that is separate from society. And I think most people would not disagree with the statement that scientific and technological development changes society. The very fact that I'm speaking to you from my home in Los Angeles is a simple proof of the power of technoscience to change the world. However, what STS scholars highlight is that this influence is not happening in only one direction. There isn't such a thing as a scientist in their lab, neutral, apolitical, beyond culture, who develops something that gets disseminated to society and only then acquires social, cultural, and political meaning. So our argument as STS scholars is that science and technology not shape society, do not only shape society, but that society also shapes science and technology. In fact, our argument is that you cannot even separate those two spheres, they're co-produced. Society, its values, its meaning, its politics is very much part and parcel of science and technology. And in my presentation today, I'll prompt us to reflect on this co-production between science and technology and society. So that's my STS side. As an anthropologist, I tried to examine this co-production mainly through ethnographic research. In that case, participant observation is one of the most important methods of data collection based on what's called deep hanging out, which allows the anthropologist to immerse herself in a cultural group or social experience. So I'll start by my presentation by doing something anthropologists often do, which is to take us to my fieldwork. And now in anthropology, it's customary for us to read our presentations. I know that's not always the case in every field, but I'm not seeing you, but you're seeing the slides, right?
Yes, we see your slides.
Okay, perfect. Okay, because I'm not seeing anything. So if there's any issue, you don't raise your head, like speak into the microphone. So I'll read, but I'll make as conversational as possible. So on a particular hot morning in Juazeiro in Bahia, northeast of Brazil, where days are often hot, I arrived at the biofactory to find workers and scientists celebrating. Once they saw me, they called, "Luisa, come see how wonderful the posturas are, the lanes were." I noticed that the 10 to 30 centimeter paper strips had much darker strains than others I had seen before. These stains contain hundreds, even thousands of eggs from Aedes aegypti mosquitoes. I asked if they knew why the females had laid more eggs. They explained that another container with water and an extra paper strip had been placed inside the cages. One of the scientists, Jacqueline, commented, "Maybe they were too stressed with not enough space before. It's great that they have laid so many more eggs. We really needed to increase production." The idea of producing mosquitoes, Aedes aegypti mosquitoes no less, might seem strange at first. I know not for this audience is not strange, but usually people do think it's strange. This mosquito species is notorious for being the vector of pathogenic viruses that can cause diseases such as dengue, chikungunya, Zika, and yellow fever. This strangeness of producing mosquitoes was exactly what had lured me to Juazeiro, to this biofactory that was mass-producing a version of Aedes aegypti, genetically modified to carry a transgene that could prevent the mosquito's offspring from reaching adulthood. These modified insects were to be released in hopes that they would mate with the wild Aedes aegypti, leading to the death of the heterozygote progeny of such couplings. The goal was to reduce the overall Aedes aegypti population, lessening the transmission of mosquito-borne diseases. So from April to May 2013, I conducted ethnographic fieldwork in Juazeiro with scientists and workers producing this transgenic organism, exploring the apparently paradoxical situation of deploying mosquitoes as a strategy to tackle mosquito-borne diseases. And if anyone is interested, I can later during the Q&A, I can explain better how this genetic modification works. But just to clarify that here, I'll be talking about a version of modified mosquitoes that were released in 2013. And since then, other types of transgenic mosquitoes have been developed and released in Brazil. So today I'll present on my findings based on my ethnographic research, which I also published in this article, which Rex mentioned. Here I report on how my scientist interlocutors worked to make the Aedes aegypti embody a solution to the very problem the insects constituted. They hoped to turn mosquitoes, usually framed as enemies of humans, into an odd kind of ally, agents that could undo their own kind. In doing so, my ethnographic research also allowed me to review aspects related to regionalism, class, and gender in the release of transgenic mosquitoes. In what follows, I offer ethnographic descriptions of rearing practices inside the biofactory and of public engagement activities, examining the more than human politics of mosquitoes, that is, the politics that goes beyond the human. This genetic modification of the Aedes aegypti was done on the grounds that, since this species can transmit pathogens, its absence would be beneficial to human health. Therefore, in the case of this genetic strategy, Value was generated through the experience of not being bitten by the transgenic males, as well as the embodied promise that these insects would reduce the population size of their biting species. It was this non-encounter, this absence of future severing of human-mosquito relations that motivated the rearing and release of these value-added insects. And in the article version, I have a more theoretical anthropological discussion about this concept of non-encounter value, which I won't talk so much right now, but I'm happy to talk about it in the Q&A. As a result, to implement this strategy, proponents of this technology had to re-engineer not only the mosquito body, but also three different aspects of the human-mosquito encounter, the human-mosquito relationship. First, they had to transform an insect that has long been seen as an enemy into an ally. Second, they needed to make rather than kill mosquitoes, which is what people have been doing for more than a century now. Third, they had to re-envision human-mosquito encounters as one in which mosquitoes, especially the released ones, do not bite humans. However, as they tried to make sense of and explain these radically novel terms of human-mosquito relations, proponents of these genetically modified organisms, nonetheless, often made use of older versions of animality. They deploy antiquated sociobiological ideas about male as heroic and horny, and female as villainous and picky. Apparently, novel mosquito-human sociologies were quickly narrated in ways that align with all too hegemonic gendered human sociality. So tracing the three different aspects of human-mosquito encounter, these three here, is what will guide my presentation today. And in the end, I'll provide some final considerations and say a few things about my current research project. At the end of the day of my fieldwork in Juazeiro, I sat in bed trying to write up my notes for the day. As ethnographers, we produce these things called ethnographic diaries, where we register the interactions we have in the field. But doing that in my small room with a noisy fan that was doing nothing to alleviate the suffocating heat was a challenge. So I decided to move to the porch to breathe in some fresh air. Not long after I sat down, an itch on my left arm prompted a quick swat from my right hand. I turned my hand over to see a dead mosquito with blood smeared on my skin. As I inspected the dead mosquito that afternoon, my trained eye recognized its black and white stripes as a telltale signature of the Aedes aegypti. Female mosquitoes need blood to mature their eggs. An Aedes aegypti that bites someone with dengue can become infected with the virus, and later, as it bites another person, the mosquito's infected saliva enters the human body. It is in the second act of biting that mosquitoes transmit diseases. That day on the porch, as I stare at the mosquito and at blood on the palm of my hand, my fear of contracting dengue fever became a visceral reminder of what is behind the sometimes abstract numbers, showing the increase and spread of cases. The city was having an outbreak, and the bite, that fleeting encounter, could have infected me with the virus. So historians of health and science have shown that once the scientific community agreed that the Aedes aegypti bites could transmit yellow fever, the insect became the target of strategies to control the disease. It made possible a rhetoric that claimed that death has wings. Mosquitoes then became not only ecologically, but ontologically defined as vectors, as enemies. I won't go in detail about the history of mosquito control in Brazil, which I have written about together with historian Gabriel Lopes. But what's important to highlight is that Brazil has a long history of attempting to eradicate Aedes aegypti. But if there's a continuity in the human effort to not encounter these insects, considered to be in a potentially dangerous somatic proximity, what is new here is the use of mosquitoes themselves in these endeavors. This transformation from an organism that carries a problem, a pathogen, to one that carries the solution, its own species self-annihilation, turns mosquito into something valuable. To make mosquitoes have value here can be understood not only through the money saved from health and death costs, but also the value of the mosquito as a commodity. The transgenic Aedes aegypti examined here contains a genetic contract developed and patented by Oxitec, a spin-off company of Oxford University in the United Kingdom. In 2013, Oxitec was trying to assure that their mosquito technology would be considered an effective tool to address diseases. Some scientists, especially those working at Oxitec, claim that after a prolonged period of releases, the Aedes aegypti population can be suppressed to a point that results in the mosquito's local elimination. However, most entomologists I have talked to assert that even if the population size is reduced, local elimination of the species through this genetic strategy is infeasible. Thus, with this genetic strain, eradication was not truly the goal. In fact, the strategy entails the ongoing continuous releases of this transgenic organisms. If releases are discontinued, the mosquito population tends to return to its so-called original numbers or might even increase. Indeed, results published after my fieldwork show that there was a suppression of the Aedes aegypti population during sustained releases, but once these stopped, there was a gradual recovery to pre-release numbers, bringing no long lasting benefit to residents of the areas where experiments were conducted. This need for constant releases creates a business model in which, to prevent Aedes aegypti future generations, there must be a continuous production and release of transgenic mosquitoes. In other words, Oxitec hoped that what was considered a pest would be embraced as a product. And here we can think of how certain values are inscribed within the design of a technology. And this is something a lot of SDS scholars have written about it if you're interested. However, during my fieldwork, I could not investigate the promissory process of communication or capital accumulation in the mosquito, since at the time, the mosquito was not really yet a commodity. It had been approved in Brazil only as part of a research experiment in a collaboration between the São Paulo University and Mosca Meji, a not-for-profit social organization where the biofactory was located. And here then, let's talk about the regional politics present in the release of these transgenic mosquitoes. Although releases were being conducted in the northeast of the country, all staff scientists working on the mosquitoes, as well as the biofactory director of the time, were from Brazil's southeast. So here you can see São Paulo. This is the southeast region is for here. As someone who's also from the southeast region, I was quickly categorized by the biofactory workers. All of them were local, so here from Bahia. As yet another sulista, as they called us, researcher who was there temporarily to gather knowledge about the releases. Even though the biofactory had initially been established in 2005 to control pests and contribute to regional agricultural development, and even though the researchers, all of them white Brazilians, most of them from São Paulo here, were convinced they could improve the national policy for mosquito-borne diseases and promote national scientific development, the workers were aware of the politics of conducting experiments in the northeast Sertão, the semi-arid hinterlands of the country, a historically marginalized part of Brazil. The anthropologist of science, Rosana Castro, has described how Brazil's social and racial, and in this case also regional, inequalities are reframed by scientists as conditions that enable and propel scientific research in the country, what Castro defines as opportune precariousness. Thus, the works would make jokes and remarks about the sulistas, and that can be understood as social commentaries on the regional geopolitics at play in these experiments, in these experimental releases. Medical anthropologist Joanna Crane has also described similar circumstances in collaborations between Uganda and US-based universities, where the poverty and inequality that that institutions in the US or in Europe are aspiring to remedy is also what makes their global health programs both possible and popular. Crane defines these as valuable inequalities. In the Brazilian case, we could call it national valuable inequalities. If there are well-established inequalities within the politics of global North and global South interactions within Brazil, our global North is the South. So Brazil South is the global North of Brazil. During my fieldwork, mosquitoes were released in a few neighborhoods in the outskirts of Juazeiro, but preparations were underway for a large-scale citywide project in Jacobina, also located in the state of Bahia. In the next session, I described how these transgenic mosquitoes needed to be reared as care-demanding organisms, as well as standardized productions of large-scale manufacturing. During my fieldwork, scientists and workers in the biofactory were seeking ways to allow them to cater to the mosquitoes' needs while simultaneously improving the efficiency needed for mass production. The project aimed at releasing only non-biting transgenic males and sex separation of mosquitoes, described as sexagem or sexing, was arguably the most labor-intensive task of production. To produce males, however, there was a focus on the reproduction capacity of females, as my initial vignette on the number of eggs show. The rearing of mosquitoes in the biofactory becomes an almost character insect version of what feminist scholars have long been pointing out as the perception of women merely as the means of reproduction. So here, let's unpack some of the more than human gendered politic of these transgenic mosquitoes. We release these mosquitoes and they do all the work for us. This technology works so well because the best thing machos, males, do is to find famous females. All machos think about is sex, one of the scientists jokingly noted. So if I had more time, I would make this more conversational and I would want to pause and think with you what this quote means. But you can all do it and think about it. What are the meanings of this quote before I tell my interpretation? So I heard many variations of these kind of jokes during my fieldwork about horny machos that, driven by their insatiable and unending desire for sex, won over picky femias. The person telling the joke, almost always a man, would usually not specify that the joke was about mosquitoes, therefore implying that these remarks refer not just to insects, but also to more than human mosquitoes' gender and sexualities, so insect and humans alike. And that's where why the joke was funny, right? Because there was this implicit connection between mosquitoes and humans. This particular way of understanding sexuality was framed as natural, a supposedly natural instinct of males to hunt down females, was mobilized to explain the approach's efficacy and naturalness, reinforcing a particular understanding of nature. Although scientists framed the project as mosquitoes doing the work, rearing transgenic mosquitoes required a lot of human work, which often caused some resentment from workers. And here, let's talk about class dynamics within these projects, and within this project. In one of my first days visiting the biofactory, I joined Francisca and Jonathan, two workers there in preparing food for the transgenic larvae. To maintain standardized production, the genetically engineered mosquitoes were given the same fish food that was used in the English laboratory in which they were developed. But in Brazil, this fish food became an expensive and imported brand. Moreover, the fish food needed to be ground twice and later sifted to turn into a very fine powder. These steps ensured that there were no clumps, so it could be precisely measured and more easily dissolved in water. While they went through this arduous and messy process, Jonathan remarked, all this important food, and we need to go through all this effort to feed them. After a short reflective pause, he said, shaking his head, these mosquitoes have a better life than I have. So again, pause and think about the meaning behind this quote. Such comments and jokes about the good life and high maintenance of these mosquitoes were common within the biofactory, where many workers came from low-income backgrounds. The workers would often call attention to the apparent contradiction of spending so much time, energy, and money on rearing an organism that is often an unwanted guest in houses and in our houses and bodies. Perhaps the remarks about these mosquitoes remained to be at the same time commodity and labor, were also social critique on how more value seemed to be given to the labor of mosquitoes than that to the human labor needed to implement this strategy. These instances also highlight the paradoxical situation in which situations that outside are fiercely avoided, so Aedes aegypti laying eggs, developing to adulthood, and mating, could only happen at the biofactory because of labor-intensive efforts and expensive infrastructure. The viability of this strategy, however, depended not only on the capacity to manufacture mosquitoes, but also on the local human population, perceiving released mosquitoes as severing the human-mosquito relation. In the next session, I describe the different ways in which these scientists attempted to redefine the mosquito-human encounter of biting being bitten. Aedes aegypti is highly urban, cosmopolitan, and anthropophilic, with a long history of living with and alongside humans. Females bite blood because blood is a requirement to enable the mosquito's reproduction. But humans usually do not want the bite, do not want the insect's proboscis piercing their skin, and do not want mosquito saliva, which might contain pathogens. In this multi-species interaction, the exchange of fluids means the survival of some beings, mosquitoes, but a potential threat to others, us. The bite, then, is a haptic reminder of how the production of diseases is always relational in our porous and permeable bodies. And later in the Q&A, I can tell more about how the scientists and technicians manage the biting being bitten encounter inside the biofactory. But I think more interesting is the human mosquito encounter outside the biofactory. So I will focus on that. As part of the group's public engagement efforts, I travel over the course of a weekend to Jacobina with a worker and a staff scientist to organize an event before releases in the city. We set up a small tent in the main shopping street, and we brought a box of fine mesh net packed with swarming transgenic mosquitoes to showcase. Can see it here. While we prepared for the day's activities, the scientist, Pedro, confirmed that there were only males in the box, putting his hand inside and making sure none of the mosquitoes would bite him. He knew that errors can happen in sex separation based on pupil size, and then one single biting mosquito would be enough to alarm those around him, failing the expected goal of acquiring public support. Throughout the day, passersby were invited to put their hands inside the box and confirm that they would not be bitten. To have the hands surrounded inside a box teeming with mosquitoes became an evidentiary practice. To have a hand surrounded by swarming Aedes aegypti was to have proximity without the bite, a kind of somatic test to establish a new kind of human-mosquito relation. That day in Jacobina, as we stood underneath the tent, one person passing by pointed to the box of swarming mosquitoes and asked, Are these the mosquitoes that dengue, the dengue mosquitoes? The person looked at me for a reply, but I genuinely did not know how to respond. The sameness or not of these transgenic mosquitoes with their non-transgenic counterparts was, and still is, the very question intriguing me. But Pedro quickly came towards us and answered, no, this is a transgenic mosquito. The person skeptically stared at the box. So the scientist started to describe how the transgenic mosquito strategy worked, how the group releasing it had been dealing with this strain for a long time, and how the experiments in Juazeiro and other parts of the world had been done. Then he added, we are only releasing males. They are the heroes that arrive to fight dengue. It is only the females that bite for blood. It's she who is the villain in this story. So another I'm sure many of you have seen, if you're interested in mosquitoes and transgenic mosquitoes, I won't share the video again, but we can, I won't share the video now, but we can, if it's something we're interested in the Q&A, I can quickly share it. It's about 2 minutes. But I'll talk about it in a little bit. So in this Axitech early promotional video, we can clearly see, again, this villainous portrayal of the female mosquito. This is a short animation of an interview with two anthropomorphized Aedes aegypti, a female and a male. So outfitted with tiny high heels, the female, Aegypta, is depicted as having an abrasive and unkind personality. Her recurrent laugh sounding particularly evil. When confronted about transmitting dengue, Aegypta disdainfully dismisses the whole thing as not being her problem, while also mocking the many failed human attempts against her. She even scorns the male mosquito, Aedes, for being a vegetarian, and being good at nothing more than following her around. Aedes, on the other hand, is characterized in a much more sympathetic way. The male is soft-spoken and seemingly submissive until it is revealed at the very end that he is secretly deceiving the female. Aedes is a transgenic mosquito. In the case of transgenic Aedes aegypti, it seemed that to make sense of the remaking of human mosquito encounters into significantly new terms, proponents of this technology had to hold on to more than human gender stereotypes of horny males and picky females, of heroic males and villainous females. And to frame the male transgenic mosquito as an ally, a hero, proponents of this strategy also had to foreground the act of biting and the biological need for blood, something only females see, as the defining characteristic in the negative human-mosquito relationship. So now for just some final considerations. To examine the development of novel mosquito technologies as an anthropologist and SDS scholar is crucial, I argue, especially if we consider the relationship between climate change, emerging disease ecologies, and the politics of knowledge production. While environmental discussions, both in the natural and the social sciences, have focused on the negative impact that climate change has on insects and other animals, which might even cause some species to go extinct, and of course, these are very crucial and pressing conversations, it's important to highlight that for the Aedes aegypti, global warming has been a boon. Projections show that with shorter and warmer winters, the Aedes aegypti will likely soon thrive in large parts of Europe and the United States, producing a new mosquito epoch that might reshape current epidemiological geographies. For my current project, I examined the place of Brazilian mosquito ecologists within what I call the reinvention of mosquito science, these novel technologies being developed after a century of anti-mosquito campaigns that have produced only temporary results. A prominent entomologist I interviewed memorably said, "When it comes to mosquitoes, the world will become Brazil." In other words, due to the climate change-driven global expansion of the Aedes aegypti, other places might soon endure the outbreaks currently besetting Brazil. So my project, "The World Will Become Brazil, Ecologies, Epidemics, and the Reinvention of Mosquito Sciences," focus on the Aedes aegypti to examine how climate change is not only creating new epidemiological geographies, but also prompting epistemic shifts. Therefore, I investigate how Brazilian researchers depicted mosquito ecologies as a locus point to produce a Brazilian science that would challenge the geopolitics of knowledge production in a global north-dominated science. Yet, I also show how, even as they questioned hierarchies within knowledge making, my interlocutors reproduced long-standing racialized inequalities within Brazil. And I'll stop here, but I hope that after today you can examine novel mosquito technologies, not just mosquito technologies, but any kind of new technology, attending to how politics are very much part and parcel of how they are designed, implemented, and promoted. Thank you.
That was really interesting. Thank you, Luisa. Okay, so we'll now open up for discussion. And just a reminder that if you'd like to ask your question yourself, use the raise your hand function. And if not, throw it in the chat and I'll read it for you. Okay. Max, would you like to unmute yourself?
Yes. Thank you. That was really very interesting. So I also develop similar sort of strains, but agricultural pests, not mosquitoes. And I've sort of been following the Oxitec story in Brazil. So were they successful? Right? Were they with their sort of branding of the mosquitoes as sort of friendly mosquitoes? I've heard Oxitec say they were, that the people where they were releasing the mosquitoes were very supportive. I just wonder if, you know, that these strategies they were using, sort of depicting males as the good guys, transgenic males anyway, whether that was, you know, was it worked? Because, you know, there was, at the same time, there was the anti-GM crowd were pretty critical of Oxitec. You know, I don't know whether people in Brazil would have been aware of that as much as people in Europe.
So should I answer one by one, or do you? Yeah. Okay. No. So thank you for this question, and I would like to just first say I'm not entomologist or not ecologist, so I can talk. I know about the critiques, and I can say some words about it. But I won't. I can't tell you if they were successful or not in case of in like controlling the mosquito. I did read that. Their current releases are not in the same place where these releases happen. So they moved to São Paulo, where they have their production now. And data does show that in this place where the first releases happened, the population went back to original numbers, which I find it, like if you're implementing a new technology, you owe the people you're doing these experiments some long-lasting support, right? If you get it. So that's one thing that I'm critical. If they were successful or not in reframing the male, they weren't doing as active because Oxitec was only a kind of partner in this project, and not, this is pre kind of their approval to have to release it as a product, right? As a something a city could hire. And then I think it's interesting, for example, that this video they released is partially in English, partially in Portuguese. So it's, you can see the efforts were there, but like they're, it still required people to at least read the subtitles. So I don't know how much effort there was at that point to reframe the mosquito in that sense. But I talk about it in my article, they had a hard time differentiating between the transgenic mosquito and the other mosquitoes already existing in the city, in the places, right? And I think that's one of the core of the longer version of this article is that you're releasing these mosquitoes. It only makes sense to release these mosquitoes if you're releasing in a place that already has mosquitoes and ask people to differentiate between those two, which are like very hard to differentiate, becomes an issue, right? So you have this issue between having a mosquito as a friend and an enemy at the same time. So when I arrived there, I found out they were releasing mosquitoes in the middle of the day, which is probably the worst time to release mosquito because it's very hot. And they told me that earlier on, they were releasing mosquitoes at the end of the day, which is probably the best. But that's also the time, as my vignette shows, that's a time where other mosquitoes, Culex and other kind of other species, and the Aedes aegypti themselves, are getting out to bite. So people would see that swarming mosquitoes and they were being bitten, they would be like, this is the same mosquito, you're releasing mosquitoes that are biting me. And all the effort was mostly to like focus on framing mosquitoes as the new mosquitoes as these non-biting animal or the insects. Although we know that the release, as I mentioned, right, the sex separation is not 100%. So they were releasing some females as well. So I think the effort to the difficulty to frame mosquito as a friend, as Oxitec later framed, like the friendly Aedes or in Portuguese Aedes do bem, was limited because of the fact that there are other mosquitoes and people mostly couldn't make a difference between the two, right? So it was very kind of precarious separation between actually being able to reframe the mosquito. They were trying, but I don't think they managed to kind of truly reframe the mosquito as a friend.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it'd be hard to do that. I have a question. I find it interesting that one of your criticisms is that there was not a lasting effect when the scientist at least knew that there wouldn't be a lasting effect once they stopped releasing. So, and actually that could have been viewed as a positive because it's like, oh, hey, we can actually, you know, it's reversible. We don't have to keep it. So I'm curious why they did it or why you think they didn't play that up and communicate that and why you landed on that being a criticism.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. I agree that when I was talking to them, they would tell me, well, if this doesn't work, it will the genetic modification won't stay within the population. Although that was also, we saw that it wasn't really true. But anyway, I can understand the argument. But when they were promoting, they were like promoting the technology saying, this will suppress mosquitoes. And they weren't saying this will suppress for a year and then we're gonna leave. I did my master's in Europe and I came thinking people would be very, very critical of genetically modified mosquitoes because there was this very strong discourse in Europe. I didn't find that particularly strong critique of GM mosquitoes when my field work, this is also what anthropologists get to gather data. My data was mostly with the scientists and technicians. So I didn't do surveys with the population. I talked with residents while I was with the workers and scientists. But I didn't see the same kind of resistance to the technology itself that I thought I would see when I was training in Europe. But there were, so for example, when I arrived, they told me the technology had been postponed and people were criticizing, saying, see, because someone in the government took up their money, although it wasn't, it was like a regulation thing, it was nothing connected. And I don't think they made it clear that it was a temporary thing. Although scientifically that can be good, I think people were willing to, be part of this because they thought mosquitoes would be, the population of mosquitoes would be reduced. So I see the kind of challenge, right? Because scientifically it's a good thing, but I think people were kind of understanding that mosquitoes would be reduced and they were for temporarily, but once mosquitoes really stopped, they weren't anymore. So I think that's, I don't know if it's, or it didn't have to be the long-lasting effect or the kind of reparation or whatever you want to call it, doesn't have to be mosquito population, but other forms of kind of contributing to the community in a longer way than just to gather data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. We have a question in the chat from Henry Schaefer. He says, how could it possibly have a lasting permanent effect unless it was done in all of Brazil, all of South America, probably everywhere in the world?
Yeah. That's what my other entomologists interlocutors say, right? So if you talk with Oxitec and some of the my Brazilian scientists that collaborate with Oxitec, they would say that you could suppress the mosquito population to a point where the population is reduced with long-lasting effects. And that's kind of how they promoted the technology. But I don't think in this audience, I need to explain that you can have mosquitoes coming from other regions. You have cities are a great, mosquitoes are already proliferating, right? So it's, I think imagining that this technology could suppress without the continuous release of mosquitoes I'm not an entomologist, I'm not an ecologist, but I see the argument made by my colleagues who are entomologists who say this The goal was never to suppress. The goal is to maintain these continuous releases. And that's what's interesting for me, right? Because it requires, if it's being done by a company, it requires the constant that you kind of buy into this technology that you have to constantly be releasing. So it's interesting to think about what kind of things are being, when you're designing technology, there are certain kind of values that are also being part of being inscribed within the technology, maybe in a more explicit or implicit way. But I think that's a good case to think about how economics becomes part of this technology.
Hey, Zach, would you like to ask your question? You're muted. You need to unmute. Okay. Zach, you there? Oh, okay. If you want to just throw it in the chat, I'll read it for you. And while we wait for Zach to type up his question, I'll ask another question, which is, okay. So these mosquitoes are only dengue when dengue is present in the population. Otherwise, they're just nuisance, right? They bite, they itch. But unless dengue is present and it's spreading, they're not going to be dangerous. We're, and I can't remember the details of this particular study, but were these mosquitoes released in a place that frequently had dengue? And were they used during a time where there was a epidemic?
Yes. So actually now Aedes aegypti is present across Brazil in all states, and all states have cases of dengue yearly, some years more than others. This year we're having a really bad outbreak, an epidemic. So yes, it was being released. It was not just being released in a place that has frequently cases of dengue. It's hard to kind of express how much killing mosquitoes is like inscribed in our in Brazilian mentality, right? It's part of our education. There's a year in which we learn that mosquito, the Aedes aegypti, I always give this example as kind of to illustrate. Most Brazilians in urban in cities will recognize the scientific name Aedes aegypti. So you can have a sense of like how scientific narratives are very much part of like quotidian practices, right? They will call either mosquito the dengue mosquito, and or they will know Aedes aegypti as a, or at least recognize it as a name. So the kind of ubiquitous campaigns about killing mosquitoes, about mosquito as the enemy, is part, I think, why they like there is a recognition of failures of current vector control approaches, even within kind of public health workers who are the ones tasked with eliminating, like they visit homes to kind of look for breeding spots. So there is a general recognition that current vector control approaches are not working. And maybe that's why Brazil has been kind of open to new technologies. But at the same time, it makes this reframing of the mosquito even harder, right? Because again, the mosquito as an ally, as a friend, is released because of this mosquito as an enemy. But this mosquito as an enemy has to stay there looming, right, as a potential threat in order to justify this other mosquito. And that's what I think it's like both a challenge and as an anthropologist interesting for me, right? How did they navigate between both differentiating the two mosquitoes, but also saying it's kind of the same. So, right, like the differences and similarities between the two and the reframing and kind of maintaining the reframing of an enemy it was the crucial. But so, yes. And I actually, that's why I was bitten a few times in the city. I was very afraid of, I didn't catch dengue, but I was very afraid because I knew they were having a bad outbreak at that time.
Sorry, I'm muted. David Andel asked, did you hear any gendered models that did not reinforce this stereotype of male equals hero and female equals villain?
Yeah, so it's interesting because the Zach question, I also did field work with the Wolbachia group for my more recent project, which is interesting because it's one that releases both males and females, right? So there is a different, like within the technology, there's that difference. And I also want to say that I now did this research more than 10 years ago, right? I think discussions about gender have changed a lot in Brazil in the last 10 years. And I don't think, I mean, the Yoxitec video is still up there, but I will give it that. I don't know if they would reframe or if it would be so socially accepted nowadays to make these jokes, this constant jokes about horny males and picky females and all mashes think about is sex, which was very prevalent when I was doing field work and made the, not only I, but the female tech, the women technicians also very uncomfortable. So I don't know that this is also 10 years ago. I will like to think that maybe that changed. But for example, the Wolbachia one, because they were releasing males and females and they had like each one is doing their part, kind of both males and females are doing their part. So there wasn't, I didn't see any of that. There was still the kind of reproduction is the mosquito is doing the work and reproduction is kind of the natural instinct of male and females. And the other project I accompany is the irradiated mosquitoes in the northeast of Brazil, where they're also only releasing males. And interesting enough, although there's strong similarities between the kind of the logic of the irradiated mosquitoes and there's do sex separation, irradiate the males and release the males. There was never kind of mention of like male sexuality, maybe because it was a woman scientist and the technicians were women as well. I don't know if there makes a difference, maybe because it was 10 years later. But the stereotypes, the gender stereotypes were not part of the narrative. There was, again, the naturalness of reproduction, but it wasn't gendered in the same way as it was with the transgenic mosquitoes. So I do think there was something about that particular moment that kind of made it, or the need to, Oxitec was also one of the first ones. So they were doing it in larger scale. So maybe this need to do it at a larger scale. But again, what are you reinforcing as you do these efforts, right?
Yeah. So along you may have covered some of this, but just to read Zach Brown's question, did you interact with the World Mosquito Program, which you talked about, and their Wolbachia technology at all? They've done effective trials in Brazil, and that tech would theoretically be more permanent. It also involves a natural biocontrol agent instead of genetic engineering, which could affect the discourse.
Yeah, thank you for this question. So indeed, and I think this self, maintaining was very much how they reframe. I'm just publishing, just submitted an article that tries to think about that in the sense of how nature was mobilized as well, how they were constantly contrasting themselves with the transgenic mosquitoes, and they call their like more natural, they had a more natural nature, although there's still biomodification, right? It's interesting as well. The transgenic mosquito folks will criticize because Wolbachia had a much easier regulation because it was not transgenic. So it also becomes interesting how like ideas of what is natural or not are kind of change what kind of regulations are expected. But I do think that's the option that kind of the Brazilian government has been supporting. And I think it's an interesting technology. Again, I'm not an entomologist, I'm not a molecular biologist. There has been some studies that show that maybe when in higher temperatures, the Wolbachia is not as efficient in transmitting itself. So if we're thinking about rising global temperatures, we can think about that. We can also think, again, the Wolbachia group also promoted a lot of like mosquitoes are doing the work, but it required a lot of technicians going around Rio, which was often a challenge, and they put their risks and lives at risk in a kind of thing that became a bit invisible because the mosquitoes are doing the work becomes a way to kind of make invisible the human labor. So there are other other aspects that are also interesting.
Okay, Rex, I saw you put your hand down, but do you still have a question?
Yes, if time permits. My question was, you touched a little bit about co-production of knowledge. Hoping you can talk a little more about that in relation to regulatory and just social consents. And how did that happen? Or did it happen?
In relation to, sorry, to regulation?
Regulation and social consents. And also, has there been efforts to streamline impacts of the release of these mosquitoes to kind of like create a pathway to assess most of these effects and impacts that came out of the release?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I'll answer the second one first, which is, so most of the studies that were done in that area about post-release effects were about how the population grew again. So, and how there was some of the genetic material of the released mosquitoes was part of the local population. So those were the two kind of effects. Again, I'm not an entomologist and ecologist, so I can't tell you like more of what these effects means, but that these are the two points that the entomologists and ecologists that I read mention. And I haven't seen as many results from like São Paulo, where Oxitec has been doing more consent. It's also interesting to think about the politics and economics. Brazil, when these releases started, Brazil was doing very well economically. It was the ideal place to test these technologies because it was a country that had mosquito-borne diseases, but a relatively wealthy or like middle-level country. After this, it had an economic crisis, so the cities had much more less money to buy these technologies, and that was, I know it was an issue for Oxitec. Oxitec is an expensive technology, so it does require cities to, the Brazilian healthcare system is like the cities are the ones managing the budget, so the cities could hire this as a service, and there's a reason why they're in São Paulo now. It is the one of the wealthiest states. So co-production is a term within STS that just means the idea that how societies and science, like we can't understand science if we're not understanding like the particular context in which these scientific knowledges are being developed, implemented, regulated. There's a book from Sheila Jasanoff that's thinking about genetic technologies in different countries and how their deployment, and she's one of the people who thinks about co-production. For example, if we think how regulation of GM mosquitoes or any GM organisms is so different if we're thinking about regulation, right, in the US or in Brazil or in Europe, right, these different particular historical contexts of how do we understand a technology shape how technology ends up being regulated. If you have a country like Brazil, which has had issues and current outbreaks, there might be a stronger argument to release these mosquitoes than somewhere like Cayman Island or another place that has less of the outbreaks. So, and again, I'll give the Cayman Island because Cayman Island is not a country, it's a territory. So the fact that there are kind of geopolitics of why certain places are chosen to be the places of releases or not. And these are, I think, scientists are more and more aware of how these choices are being made and being more explicit. And I think this being more explicit also helps being more ethical about how, where we choose to do releases or not. So again, how both science and society are being shaped, co-production in that sense, right? These are not two spheres that are separate. The scientist is not there just doing developing their technology, and then once it's released, it has culture and social meaning. These are happening at the same time.
Okay, that was great. Thank you. Well, we're at 1 o'clock now, so we need to end for today. Everyone help me thank Louisa for a great talk and discussion. It was very interesting to get an anthropological perspective, STS perspective on the work that was done in Brazil. And just to remind everyone that next week is spring break, so we will not have a meeting, but the following week we will be meeting virtually. And our speaker will be Jennifer Rowland from the USDA, and she'll be talking about agricultural biotechnology at the USDA and beyond. So again, thank you everyone for coming and for your time, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
I just want to say thank you again for having me. Great discussion. Thank you.